Hello and welcome to our podcast.
Hello. My name is Maddie.
And I'm Gabriella.
And we are here to talk about Hereditary, the 2018 horror movie directed by Ari Aster. It's a story about grief, mostly about family whose grandmother passes away, and it just all goes a bit wrong.
It does all go a little bit wrong. So it kind of balances. The first half is kind of like a family drama, and then the horror aspects pick up later on in the story. And I think we both saw this movie when it came out in cinemas.
We did.
And then we watched it again to bring you all the best analysis.
What a lot of analysis we have.
So much. First off, did you like this film?
I really did. I think watching it the second time, I appreciated a lot more than the first time. But the second half, I didn't really like as much. I thought it kind of lost its way a bit and kind of fell into a few stereotypes and a few tropes.
Yes, I think you're right. I think this film, a lot of people have compared it to other, like, classic horrors like The Shining,
The Exorcist,
and The Exorcist, because it's got a very fresh feel to it, and I think a lot of that comes from the first half, where it was very much invested in illustrating the psychological world of the characters. It's only the last half an hour, 20 minutes, which I'd have a slight problem with.
It's a different film.
It is. It's basically like two separate films, and that's when we like descend into like a cult. Which is
demons,
naked people
on ceilings.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Which I'm not opposed to. I love a good horror movie. Like I even love a bad horror movie. But I think it cheapened some of the hard work it did at the start.
Mm-hmm. I think with all the tropes, I think some of them work, some of them work not as well. And I think avoiding some of them was beneficial. So I think, the house is a big, isolated house in the woods.
Oh, we should probably illustrate in more detail the plot to give up the tropes. So basically, it's about a family who live in a big house in the woods.
Yes.
There's a spooky tree house. There's the youngest daughter has got an unnamed social disorder.
That's true. They never really bring that up in the film, though.
They don't bring it up, but it's kind of...
Does she have an unnamed social disorder, or has she been possessed by a demon since birth?
That's a good point. The film doesn't answer that question. No. Actually, that's one of the big questions it asks.
Mm-hmm.
It's this balance of whether what's happening is supernatural or whether it's, inherited, mental illness.
I don't like the ambiguity of it, because I feel like at the end, they just prove one of the sides wrong, because it does end up being the cult, because there's other people. We, as an objective viewer, see the crowning of Peter, and we see it all happen.
We do, yeah.
So I feel like they've got two sides, the supernatural cult stuff, and then you've got the hereditary mental illness. But then in the end, they just prove the mental illness kind of wrong.
I mean, I would say that... So basically, the story opens on... the death of the grandmother, who we never see alive. It opens on her funeral day. And we are told various things about her, that she had dissociative identity disorder, and she was a horrible mother.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end you find out she's kind of like a head of this witch coven. I guess they're going to say they're witches, but they're...
It's a cult.
It's a cult, yeah. And they're worshipping one of the lords of hell. And so I guess... you'd have to be a little bit unstable
to get into that
in the first place.
Unless
would be what I say.
Inherited that from her mother.
Possibly.
How long it's been going back for.
So we've got a few topics of the film which really stood out to us, which we thought we'd discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So those are going to be...
We've got the tropes that they use, which you kind of already begun to touch on slightly. Things that we don't see, things that are excluded from the visuality of the film. Different kind of imagery that's used, and the stylistic and technical choices made by both the director and like the cinematographer. So I think they work together quite closely.
Okay, I think the tropes is probably a good place to start. So I think what distinguishes like any horror movie normally is that it's a very clearly like a genre film. And therefore, obviously, there are a lot of, there's a very rigid set of expectations that a viewer goes into it with, which actually this film did a very good job of challenging, for the most part. And so it means that I think we're all kind of geared up to read certain symbols and certain cuts and shots in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I almost forgot during the first half that it actually was a horror movie, I think because of the exclusion of a lot of tropes.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple, but for the most part, it doesn't feel like it's a horror movie. It just feels like a horrible movie where horrible things happen.
Yes, I agree. I think it does what it does quite well is it like it suggests the horror that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So you have the classic scene, the girl, I forgot what her name is, Charlie. She's in class, and a bird flies straight at the window.
Mm.
And it's not a jump scare.
It's like one of those jump scares that you laugh off because it's not actually scary.
Yeah.
It's like, ah.
But that's like that's such a classic horror trope by this point, and I think that was like, I don't, before you could stray too far away from what you think the subject matter is, it reminded you that, stuff's going to happen.
I think like the mental illness kind of thread that runs through the whole thing that we kind of start with does count as a trope, because you have all those like horror films where like there's like a crazy person and an insane asylum and all this horrible stuff. And I think, like, because, you know, they do use the trope of, like, and people who have mental illnesses being somehow connected to demons and hell and possession and stuff.
No, that's definitely true.
I think that's true. But I think they do it in a way that you don't really associate that with, you don't think, oh, right, there's, like, a history of hereditary mental illness in the family, so they're all crazy, like demon worshippers.
Yeah, I think it definitely updates the concept of these mental illnesses. Like, if anyone's seen what's that James McAvoy film,
Split,
which is about dissociative identity disorder, and it's very demonizing of it. Whereas this one, we have dissociative identity disorder again. It's mentioned, but we don't ever see that as actually what's the horrifying aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I think at least in its conclusion, by stating very explicitly, like, there's a demon.
Yes.
You kind of, we know that the bad guy here isn't undiagnosed
That's
disorders.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think the fact that they talk about, like, Annie, the mum, like, they talk about her brother who, like,
Schizophrenic,
who hung himself. And, like, he said that, like, he left in his note, he blamed the grandmother, her name Ellen.
Yes, I think
saying, so. Like, she tried to put people inside me.
Yes.
So that, I think that's another spin on the ambiguous, is it supernatural, is it mental illness?
Yeah.
We'll let you figure it out, but in the end we're just going to tell you anyway.
Yes. I'd say what I very much enjoyed throughout the movie was how well it geared the reader in, not reader, oh gosh, English student, how much it geared the audience into the perspective of separate characters.
Yes.
There wasn't really, there's not one protagonist. In some ways, you might, at certain aspects, you definitely think it's either Annie or it's Peter,
mm-hmm.
or Charlie. But it really does go between them.
It does. I think that ties in with the whole, like, dollhouse thing.
Yes.
I think we can explore in a bit more detail later on. I think there's a lot to talk about in the dollhouse thing. I suppose that's a trope as well, like, dollhouses.
Yeah, because dolls are creepy.
Dolls are creepy indeed. But with the house thing, I mean, like I mentioned briefly before, about it all takes place in a big isolated house in the woods, which later on in the film I kind of got Overlook Hotel vibes, like from The Shining.
Oh yeah, I can see
like
that.
It's like a big spooky, the house itself isn't spooky.
The house, no.
But I think, especially because it's a modern house, like in a lot of horror films when there's like a house in the woods, it's like an Evil Dead kind of cabin.
Yeah.
Or it's an abandoned house from Blair Witch.
Yeah.
Or the cabin in the woods. But this is like
a modern,
nice, pretty modern,
like I'd live there,
Scandinavian looking house that is like Scandinavian, like Goodnight Mummy, if you've seen that horror film.
I haven't.
that all takes place in a big isolated Scandinavian house, and I think that kind of displacing and moving it from like a generic spooky house to a modern one where you wouldn't expect scary things to happen does kind of shake your perceptions a bit more.
Yeah, definitely.
And that plays with the trope.
Yeah, and I'd say that also the film isn't too invested in the isolation aspect. As in, like, yes, they're in a house in the woods, but if you've, like, any other house in the woods, it's a sense of entrapment. But actually, we see the characters in other places.
I am going to disagree with you.
Okay, because I would say, what I would say is that they certainly are trapped in the situation,
mm-hmm.
but I think what is kind of frustrating is they can't escape it even if they were to, like, drive away. Because they drive places to tragic
we don't always
results.
Get to our destination.
No, they don't always make it, but they do
in one piece.
Yeah. Do you think then is
I think the theme of like isolation is a big one because at the heart of it is grief.
Yes.
I think. And that's a very isolating thing. And there's a scene when they're sat around the dinner table and like Annie's screaming at Peter and she's like, this could have brought us together as a family, we could have got something good out of this, but no. And I think that because there are a few shots of the house like in the middle of all the trees.
Oh, there are, yeah, some aerial shots.
Yeah. And I think even when they are out and about, the way it's shot does still make them seem all very like trapped. And I think kind of almost like a Calvinist kind of everything's gonna happen, the inevitability of it.
Yes, which is mentioned throughout. Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of foregrounding.
There is. Watching it the second time, really.
Second time round, yes. You definitely see where a lot of it's coming from. And I think even the first time round, you know. So, for instance, Peter, in his class, they're talking about Greek tragedies, and they're talking about whether it being inevitable makes it more or less tragic.
Yeah.
And that's kind of... looking back, it's quite heavy-handed.
That's true, because I don't know much about Greek tragedies, but this time I was like, yeah, I mean, that's quite blatant.
Yeah, and I think even every scene you have of these characters, like, out in the world, they're always very, like, entirely centred in the shot, and they're always, like, surrounded by things.
One thing that I did notice is, in just about... It's very rare that, like, two characters are in the same shot, like in the same frame together, and when they are, only one of them is in focus.
Oh yeah, okay.
It's very subtle, but like I did notice it, so I think that's like a really, really subtle way of kind of showing that they're not entirely like connected.
Yes, there's definitely a large disconnect between the central characters, and I think that some of the stuff they did with focus was very interesting. Like, I think when we are at, in the first, well, not the first scene, but it's very near the beginning, there's the grandmother's funeral, and you have the part where everyone's coming up to see the coffin, and Charlie, the youngest daughter, is there, and she is entirely in focus, and everything else is out of focus.
Because she was the favourite.
Because she was the favourite, and also it kind of, this is what I think the movie does absolutely the best, is how it sets up Charlie.
Oh.
This is major spoilers, but it sets up Charlie to be its protagonist. And I think lots of horror movies have...
The trope of the spooky child.
It's a spooky child, mm-hmm. and it's normally a girl.
Yeah.
this is not a slasher film, it's not the last girl, but you kind of expect her to be the central character.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, all the marketing behind the film certainly featured her very heavily. So I think in lots of cases, like, I would avoid horror movie trailers because it always gives away all the best scares. But this movie, I think, has one jump scare in the whole thing.
Aside from the bird at the window.
aside from the bird. And so they didn't spoil any jump scares, and it also really did make you think that Charlie was going to be the central figure.
Yeah.
But she's not. She dies within the first half an hour.
I think I checked, it's like 35 minutes.
Yeah, and that is absolutely amazingly done.
That is like Psycho when it's
Very, very similar. I remember watching Psycho for the first time. And when
I
was
think
like,
Marion Crane's gonna be.
Yeah, you think she's the main character, and then suddenly she's dead, and then you're, as an audience, you're kind of left untethered.
Yeah.
Because now you don't. Anyone can die.
You don't know who to associate
with. Yeah, exactly.
I think that's like. Because I mean, we all, like, when you think of Psycho now, even if you've not seen it, you think of like the shower scene.
Yes.
So you kind of are aware of it in a sense, but you'd assume it happens a lot later on.
Yes.
But when it first came out and no one knew. I think that's a lot more like this is now, when it's like, oh god, that just happened. I think there are quite a few references to other films.
Oh yes, we certainly picked up on a few. For instance, the very first shot of the movie is out of a window. So it's from inside the house, looking out at the window at the treehouse. And it starts at the treehouse, and then it slowly zooms out through with like a deep focus shot. We thought that was very Citizen Kane.
And then because then it pans out of that, then it like moves round, and then we see that like house like cut out, which we did get kind of rear window feelings from.
Yeah, because it pans all the way around the mother's workshop, and like kind of inhumanly, and then it settles on one of the small houses, and zooms in into one of the rooms, and then that room, it becomes like the real room.
I love that begins. Shot.
It's very interesting.
Incredible.
I think it does really, it's quite unsettling, because in the back of your mind, you're like, this is all in this small house.
And it's not even like a completed house, is it?
No, it's not. It's not finished. Yeah.
I also noticed, I know you've not seen them, but I picked up on it. You know the scene at, it's Charlie's funeral, where they like lower the coffin into the ground, and then it moves down and you see all the dirt and the worms underneath. I got a lot of David Lynch vibes from that.
Uh-huh.
Because in Twin Peaks, the show, there's a section where, like, it's a daughter's funeral and the coffin's being lowered into the ground quite similarly. And also in Blue Velvet, which is another Lynch film, like, the opening shot is, like, this really idyllic, like, perfect-looking town. Kind of, like, that shot looked really pretty.
Yeah.
And then, like, it goes into the grass and you see all, like, the dirt and the worms, and it's, like, there's bugs crawling on top of each other.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, I've seen this before.
Yeah, I think that was such an interesting shot, when like the one of the coffin lowering, because it seemed like the last part of Charlie's perspective that you get in the film.
I thought it looked quite whimsical as well, with all like the vivid colours and
I think symmetry and graphic blocking is what we could talk about, and I think this would come back to, so the mother makes miniature houses, she's an artist. And so we begin looking at her miniature houses, and I'd say a lot of the blocking and the scene and set designs mimic like a toy house.
Mm-hmm. The blocking kind of looks like the characters had in place there, like dolls.
Yes.
Like some sort of bigger, higher being.
Yes, and I think where I noticed it most was in the school. You have all these desks, and they're all perfectly lined up, kind of Wes Anderson style. And then also, Annie goes to like a grief, what's it, I don't know what they're called.
Like a meeting.
A grief meeting thing.
Support group.
A support group, yes. And everybody is sat in a perfect circle, centred in the shot, and she is the very middle seat.
I think that was very, very well done. Yeah?
Yeah, I agree.
We like the blocking.
We did, yeah.
I did learn as well, because there's so many like distant shots in the film, like inside the house. I think the reason that there's a lot of kind of isolation that it looks like is because the shots, like the camera is very far away from the action.
Oh yeah.
Even though it's in the same room. And it turns out they had to build the entire house on a studio where they could take the walls in and out so they could move further back.
Oh, I see.
I think
kind of
brings the dollhouse thing into the real world.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because they're literally filming it from the outside of the house. Okay,
I thought that was a really interesting, like, technical thing to do.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think another aspect, and I'm not sure how, if it, like, creates the same effect, but it's always, the frames of the movie are always very mobile. Mm-hmm. Like, there are very few still shots that you get. Especially, like, I think where I've noticed this most was any scene when there's some sort of like emotional conversation, the camera always behaves in kind of interesting ways. So for instance, anytime that Annie is discussing anything of emotion, we're zooming away from her and we're distanced from it. And anytime she's talking about something normal, we like slowly zoom in. And when the topic changes, we're out again.
I think it's almost like, because I mean, like the scene when Annie is like having a proper like breakdown about finding Charlie, and she's like, I want to die, I want to die, and then it pans away and we don't see her.
Yeah.
It's almost like we don't want to watch this really private personal moment.
Yes.
As like an audience, we're moved away. And I think a lot of like emotional things we don't see.
We don't, and I think that comes on to the other topic we wanted to discuss, which is like not seeing, and I think it's done to like different effects. I think personally, because when I watch horror movies, I always find that this is the suspension of disbelief works best when you see the least.
Blair Witch.
Yes, but I think that's why Blair Witch is so effective, because like the monster doesn't exist on the screen, it exists in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this movie does that very well until we get to the end, which is when it lost me a little bit.
I think the explicitness of it kind of...
Yeah.
It's like, people like to know what's going on, especially when it's like something scary. Just like as human, not necessarily as like an audience, but just as a human being.
Yeah.
You want to know the scary thing that's there.
Yeah, because ambiguity is scary.
Yes. But I think that first thing, when we don't see, I think there's so many things that we could have been shown that could have been done in a really, really like effective, horrible way, like Annie finding Charlie in the car.
Yeah, which is, I think we could probably go into what happens with this.
Yeah.
Because this is, I would say, one of the most powerful scenes I've seen in recent years. So Peter, which is the brother, is driving Charlie, his sister, to the hospital because she's going into anaphylactic shock from eating some nuts. And she's clawing at her throat and she sticks her head out of the car window and he drives past a lamppost. And so her head, straight off.
He swerves, doesn't he? There's something...
Something in the road, yeah.
I was going to say, could have been placed there by the cult.
I think it probably was.
Because the lamppost has the symbol.
It has a symbol on. Mm-hmm. So we know there's some sort of other reason why this is happening. But how it's shown is we actually see the impact and then we don't see the body.
I think for this bit, writing notes, the only thing I wrote was just dread.
Yes.
It's
such an overpowering emotional response. Because what we see instead is we have a close-up on Peter's face. And it's quite a long shot of his face. It's like 20 seconds.
Yeah. And both times now that I've seen it, I just freeze and I'm
Yeah.
Oh my god.
And it's an absolutely wonderful performance. I think he's very good throughout the whole film. And you just look at him, and I think it's because you're so situated in looking at his response to it that you kind of can't help but imagine yourself in that position. And it's the most horrible idea.
That's one of the worst things I think you could do.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Like accidentally decapitate your sister.
Yes.
And then I think not only that, but then having to go home.
Yes, so what happens is we see his face for a very long time. And then we get a shot from the outside of the car, and the car's like it's a very long shot, and then we see the car slowly start driving again, and I think this is a very like typical of the film where we don't necessarily see explicitly what the characters are thinking or what they're going to do, and you just kind of have to assume where it's going. And so he drives home and he lies in bed.
And we hear Annie say, oh, thank God they're back.
Yeah, we hear the mum say she's happy they're back, because he doesn't tell his parents when he gets home. And then we hear her saying she's going to go out the next morning, and we still get this close-up of his face while you can hear the mum open the car door and scream.
Yes. And that's, again, what we don't see.
We don't see the interaction between them.
We hear, and I think, not seeing, like, her coming in asking what's happened, or like the kind of immediate aftermath.
Yeah.
And I think leaving it to imagination is so much worse.
Yes, I think it is much worse. And also what happens later is this moment obviously is a very big impact on the relationship between Peter and his mother. And Peter is frustrated because his mum will not talk to him about it or anything else. And so I think the fact that we've missed this central discussion, we're kind of we're like positioned with the characters again, because we've also missed that confrontation.
I think I was reading up on some interviews that Ari Aster, the director, had, and one of the things that he said was he wanted the audience to be in the position of the characters. This is more on the kind of demon side of it, because they're like something like they're sacrificial lambs in a slaughter that's been going on for years, and they're only just finding out about it.
Yeah,
and I think it's that whole, we find out as much as the characters do, and we're not omniscient viewers at all.
No, not really, no.
And I think that's like a very horrible position to be in, when you're missing out on things that you can't see the Well, because I think those scenes could have been done really effectively.
Yeah.
But,
oof. Actually, in some ways, I'm glad they didn't show them. Because it's so intensely emotional that I can't imagine. It would be such an uncomfortable viewing experience.
I think it would be very hard to act.
Yes.
As well.
I think, I really do think it would be. And I imagine the whole film was very hard to act.
Speaking of the acting, something else that we did notice was Toni Collette's performance as Annie. We were trying to think for the longest time what it reminded us of.
Because she has a very distinct screaming face.
Very silent scream.
Yeah.
And we eventually figured out that it was Shelley Duvall's performance in The Shining.
Yes.
As, what's her name?
I don't remember her name.
And also, I did notice as well, because I was looking at the pictures of it, Danny, like the kid, you know, when he's like tootling around on his bike and he sees the twin sisters.
Yeah.
He does those silent scream faces, doesn't he?
Oh,
he just
opens
his mouth and he's like,
oh yeah, Hereditary. And I think also what's kind of interesting about her as a character is we have a very interesting perspective on like female hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
Which of
and motherhood.
And motherhood, definitely, which comes up a lot in horror movies. Normally you have dysfunctional mother relationships with their children.
Psycho, yeah.
Very psycho. I mean, every Hitchcock film ever, really. What's interesting about like this happening in like this situation is because normally in horror movies, as soon as somebody starts saying, I think it's got something to do with ghosts and demons, as an audience, we're like, yes, it does.
Yes.
And so we normally, we're like, yes, they're the one speaking sense, even though they're speaking like this irrational thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have here is like, it's a weird perspective shift where we're aligned with her thinking, but also we view her from other characters' perspectives.
Yeah.
And so there's a confrontation between Annie and her husband, where Annie's like saying, I need you to burn this book and it's going to set me on fire, but just do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's obviously a very like irrational, erratic behaviour. And then the husband's like, I'm not going to do that. That's crazy.
Husband's a therapist, it turned out.
Oh, wow!
Which I think adds a new dimension.
Oh, it really does. That. Yeah, I didn't know that. Because we don't see very much of him, actually, as a character, because he's not in the direct bloodline.
No. I think in the original script, Annie was originally used to be his patient.
Oh, that's dodgy.
I know.
I'm glad they got rid of that.
Yeah. I think, the whole... I didn't see her as being a particularly good mother. I mean, she said that she tried to have a miscarriage.
Yes.
Which she does tell him.
In a dream.
She dreaming?
She tells him in a dream. It's a complicated dream scene where
mm-hmm.
it's like two layers of dreaming, and so you're not quite sure at what point it's real and not real.
Almost like you yourself have some sort of mental illness.
Oh, I think that's the continuity style changes towards
mm-hmm.
the latter half of the movie, and I think in lots of ways that does mirror what's happening to the characters.
Yeah.
For instance, you have I love a match cut. There's a really good match cut of Peter sat at home and then Peter in class. And it's like his face doesn't register the change. And it does very much seem like the principles of logic are failing.
Yeah.
For both the audience and the characters.
I think I really like the match cuts where it's like just of the house and it goes from day to night. That kind of snap.
Yeah.
Because I think it's such like a slow, drawn-out film.
It is very long.
Yeah.
It's over 2 hours.
And I
just over 2 hours.
Those snaps and, like, day to night immediately kind of speed it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And kind of remind us that there is an outside world still going on. But that kind of snap isn't realistic. I mean, obviously it's not realistic because that doesn't happen. But, like, we don't really see evenings or mornings. We just see bright daytime and then, like, spooky nighttime.
Yes, that's true.
Except the seance scene, not the one at the house.
That's the early
like the
morning.
The family one.
Or like dawn.
Yeah, and nothing scary ever happens in early morning in horror films that I can think
of.
Oh,
yeah, definitely.
That's
kind
of the morning after everything horrible's happened.
If you think of like Blair Witch Project, it's always night. Night this number, night this number. What I think this film does is they like turn the lights on, but horrible things will keep happening.
Mm-hmm.
Which really does challenge. Like, you know, if, I don't know if... anyone else can relate to this, but like if you watch, when I watch a horror movie and you have the night time and the tension builds up, when it's daytime you feel like you can relax again.
Yeah.
And this movie really doesn't let you do that. It's like tense throughout.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really good way of doing it.
Yeah.
I really like that kind of Because, I mean, when we watched it together, we watched it in the morning.
We did.
Which was quite strange to watch a horror film in the morning.
Yeah, definitely.
It was like another little dimension. But, yeah.
I think,
what else have we got?
I think to finish off, we found some reviews online. I thought those would be interesting to share.
Because we both enjoy this movie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
And some people didn't. And we've got some classic Amazon one-star reviews, including FF through overly long scenes, or don't date your time. I practically FF the whole thing. Waste of over an hour of my day.
Fantastic.
Which I assume is fast forward. One star, did not like movie. From William C. Ham the IV. And this one, which I think is my favourite. Because Amazon sees fit not to contact me on any problem I may have. Yeah, what is this and who ordered it, Amazon? On his one star review of the movie.
I somehow wish that was our analysis of the film.
I think so.
Just a long, drawn out complaint to Amazon.
We've just kind of shown ourselves up now, haven't we? But, I mean, someone said that the sound is so low you cannot hear it even with it turned all the way up. To which I say, don't watch Mad Max Fury Road. Because you will be sorely disappointed.
At least I would say in this film you could definitely hear them talk.
You can. And you can definitely hear... What was... the scene in the attic, which is another trope. Spooky things going on in attics.
Yeah, always attics.
When Annie is up in the ceiling, like, slicing her neck.
Yeah, she saws her neck off.
And the subtitle said something like, flesh squelching.
It did describe flesh squelching.
It was horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible.
So, there we go. So I think what makes it a good horror movie is that it's just a good film.
And I think you're right.
It's a very pretty film, I think. It's very aesthetic and very stylized.
Yes.
And I think it really does make us care about the characters, or at least have like strong opinions on them and what we want to happen to them. And I think just the dread, it just builds
overarching
up.
Dread.
Yes. I definitely prefer the first half.
Yes.
Because it seems a lot more original and a lot more fresh. I mean, obviously in the second half it does what it does to be the genre film that it is.
Yes. I would say so.
I think it loses us a little bit.
I think you're right. I think the last bit could be handled better.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a tendency of people, when watching horror movies, and if they think it's a good movie, they tend to try and categorise it as something else.
Yes.
Like, my brother likes The Shining, but says he hates horror movies, so says The Shining doesn't count as a horror movie. Which I think is a disservice to this film and to The Shining. Because I think this film is certainly a horror movie, but I think this film, what makes it so original is that it could have been a family drama.
Yeah, I think because horror is such an established genre and it's been done so many times, and like directors do need to find new ways to scare. And I think like in new films like Get Out and The Babadook, it's a new kind of dread-filled and slow form of horror, which I think is going to be the next big thing. Because we've started from like Bride of Frankenstein,
yes,
all the universal horror things, and then like Hammer, House of Horror, and all that. And then we went to, like, the slasher films.
Yeah.
Of, like, the 70s and the 80s and what have you. And then with, like, Blair Witch, found footage.
Gosh, found footage is finally coming to an end, I guess.
I think, and then we get into, like, exorcism stuff.
Oh,
yeah. Possession
stuff.
And I think this does kind of take a lot of things from, obviously, possession things, but it does, like, make it new.
Yes, definitely.
If you would like to quote some modernists.
Oh yeah, so I think that's it. I'd recommend, if you like horror, even if you don't,
mm-hmm. Then you don't have to call it horror.
Yeah, you don't have to. Just call it something else. It's a very enjoyable movie.
It really is, and it will make you feel viscerally, deeply uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, 100%.
For quite a while to come.
So look forward to that.
Mm-hmm. And whatever you do, keep your head.
Yeah. Right, that's
it. Sorry.
Thank you very much. Yeah.